Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hi, Mark. I hope you guys are safe there in Atlanta.
We are, Mona, and I realize that your entire office is now hunkering down in New York.
No, New York City is bad. I think it's just the fact that we have so much density here. But we'll get through all this together, and we'll certainly want to keep our listeners updated with what's going on in the world whilst everybody is at home.
That's pretty much our responsibility. And with the longest running and highest rating EB5 podcast in the world, that's a responsibility that we take seriously.
So we've been talking a lot about litigation, Mark, as you know. But what we really wanted is the speaker that we have today to really tell our listeners what's going on, because we're really lucky to have John Pratt with us. John Pratt is Ira's partner.
That's right, Mona. Today, from Coral Gables, Florida, we have John Pratt. John Pratt is a partner of Kurzban, Tazzelli, and Pratt. John currently serves in the Board of Governors of AILA and previously served as a director of AILA in their South Florida chapter. John is also in the American Immigration Lawyers Association EB5 committee. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
John, there is so much to talk about, and we don't have too much time. But the one thing I would like to start, I know you're busy with litigation on so many different fronts. But one of the areas that is very important to many of our listeners is the child status protection. I do believe you have litigated on this area.
Yes, we're currently in litigation on the CSPA, or the Child Status Protection Act, coverage for obviously a dependent, a child of a Chinese investor.
Yeah, well, so let me just, for our audience, just so that they understand, when a child becomes 21, then the child is automatically, it is not part of their parents' application. However, for EB5, the child is on the application whilst the petition is in process. But if a petition goes into backlog, the actual protection doesn't work. Is that correct?
Yes, but what happens is once you file the I-526, the age is kind of frozen, and for the period of time that the I-526 is pending, what that means is from the time that you file it to the time that it gets approved, that period of time may be discounted from accruing on the child. So there's a formula that you have to take into account of the age of the child when the I-526 was filed, the age of the child when the I-526 is approved, and then deducting that period of time that it was pending. And then what happens is some people were able to file, for example, in my case, my client filed a DS-260 with the U.S. consulate in China, and she was still considered under the age. She filed it under what is called Chart B under the visa bulletin. But after the approval of the I-526, in some instances, based on policies of the Department of State, she then begins to age out again. And so that's a problem for some dependents, obviously.
Right. And it's a real problem for countries where there is backlog. And hopefully we won't see too much, but we might see a little bit coming out of that from India and definitely from Vietnam, John, because although India is likely to be current soon, we do have cases where, I know for a fact, we have cases where children have been filed when they're only weeks away from becoming 21. So that might have a problem. So, John, we have discussed a lot about the Child Protection Act in earlier podcasts, but because this is ongoing litigation, I know that our listeners are really keen to know what is going on.
Correct. Well, basically, what we're challenging is a denial based on what we believe is the incorrect application of the Child Status Protection Act by the Department of State and the consulate in China, where their policy is, you know, without getting too complex, The Child Status Protection Act says that when the visa is available, you then have to seek to acquire the visa within a year. And if you do that second step, the seeking to acquire the visa within a year, the age still law. The problem is that the Department of State devised a policy that the visa becomes available only when chart A is reached or when the priority date is reached, not when chart B is available. And what happened is there's a lot of different investors who were able to file their consular processing forms at DS-260 or file an adjustment of status in the United States when chart B was available, but they kept aging out. The children kept acquiring age. And when the chart A was reached, then they determined, you know what, you were over the age of 21. We believe that the Department of State's policy in that implementation violates the Child Status Protection Act and therefore is an arbitrary and capricious policy that could be struck down because it's basically violating the most basic tenet of the Child Status Protection Act, which is protect the children and keep family unity.
Right, right. We agree. We totally agree. So keep us updated on that, John. We really want to know what happens. I know there's going to be more and more litigation against the consulate, but I'd like to move on because we have so much to talk about. The other area that you have been very busy with is the termination of regional centers. And this is a topic that we've discussed quite a lot lately because we're seeing a lot of regional centers being issued notice of intentions of termination.
Yes, we have been litigating for quite some time a regional center where the Securities and Exchange Commission intervened. There was a lot of illegal acts and fraud and diversion of funds. And ultimately...
John, are we talking about the JP case here?
No, we're not. We're talking about a regional center that was in the state of Washington. It's very similar to JP, but there was a receiver. There the SEC got in, but... what happened over there is the receiver, in conjunction with the SEC, in conjunction with us and other attorneys, basically devised a restructuring plan to try to save the investors. Part of that restructuring plan was to get the bad people out of the regional center. Unlike JPEAK, the bad individuals control the regional center. In JPEAK, let's remember the regional center is controlled by the state.
That sounds like a big difference.
It's a huge difference. But what happened in our case is the part of the restructuring plan meant that proper regional center operators would take ownership of the regional center and fix it. And immigration basically said, well, we're going to terminate your regional center because you didn't have good oversight. Clearly, obviously, the people, the bad people that got convicted and were found guilty in the SEC had been already taken out. They had no ownership anymore. And people with clean hands and a good record were taking over. Immigration basically said that could not be cured. Once you have a bad actor doing bad things with a regional center, it was such a negative factor, it could not be overcome. We challenged that.
Right.
Ultimately, we got a district court decision that if your readers are lawyers, it's a 219 Westlaw 6790301. In American,
thank you. We do have some lawyers who listen, but we do have some non-lawyers too.
Right. That's a case called Path America Kinko v. DHS. That is the first published decision on termination of a regional center in the country. And basically what the court there said is that the agency improperly weighed the former principal misdeeds over the regional center's post-restructuring economic growth. That the agency or USCIS also conflated investment risk with the criminal actions of the regional center's former principal, and then acted in a manner that unmarooned, this is the words of the court, from the EB-5 program's goals. On a remand that was forced by the federal court, the AAO recently finally concluded that the regional center in fact established that it continues to promote the economic growth as required under the regulations. And the USCIS, after litigation and losing in litigation, reinstated the regional center and will begin to re-adjudicate I-526 petitions on the merits.
Excellent. You know, this brings us to another topic, John. We are seeing USCIS, great that they are actually coming after regional centers. There's too many of them. There are a lot of ones which do need to be closed down. What we feel, and I think this is what you're seeing, is that they are overreaching. And we're seeing this overreaching, not just in termination of regional centers, but just generally.
I think that part of what's happening, Mona, is a great point that you raised. They're overreaching. I've heard stories from people who are consulting with us where They're basically questioning at the 924 stage. They want to know a lot more level of detail and information. And it seems to me that obviously it's kind of adjudicating different aspects of the program, whether it's like if it was an I-526 or I-29, and they're cross-checking different information in different forms that have been filed to then make determinations that, you know, the information is not kosher or so it seems to me that, yes, they have ramped up their efforts to come up with concepts to try to terminate regional centers.
But I'll tell you what we're also seeing, John, we're seeing the consulate doing USCIS's work, and where USCIS has approved a petition, the consulate are now questioning basic tenants. And they're actually saying, we don't think USCIS have adjudicated this properly, and they're sending it back. We've seen this now several times.
Yes, I think that's part of the overall structure of what's happened, obviously, since, unfortunately, this administration took over, which is obviously an attack. I mean, we see it in other visas. But it's a very, what I would term, obviously, that I don't think they're following the law because it's preponderance of the evidence. It's not beyond reasonable doubt. So they're questioning at every point, whether it's I-526, I-29. And in, like you said, in some consulates, there's already reports, not just in EB-5, but other areas where the consulates are sending it back to USCIS for possible revocation. I think that this has led to more litigation and will continue to lead to more litigation.
Yes, I agree, John. Litigation is going to certainly be the byword for 2020 when we're not talking about coronavirus, that is.
Correct, correct. You know, litigation is complex, it's protracted, and it could be expensive. And
yeah.
And the one thing I would like to caution all is, but the lawyers and even the investors is that you have to know your record, because when you do these type of litigations, the record is the universe. And what I mean by that, the record is the I-526, any response to requests for evidence or notices of intent to deny, what was filed on the I-29. And usually these type of litigations are restricted to that record.
Right. That's really, really important. I think that's one of the first things that we'd always like to push out. If it's not on the record and you want to introduce something later, it's just too late.
It may be too late. Sometimes you have to make a strategic decision. Is it worth it to correct the record on a motion to reopen or motion to reconsider? Or is it better to stand on the decision? The other point that I really want to stress out is when immigration denies a petition, that's the basis for the litigation. What happens a lot of times when people file motions to reopen is you're allowing immigration, unless it's for strategic reasons to make a better record, you're only allowing USCIS another opportunity to perfect their denial. Because if they deny it, let's say for a source of funds, and you sue and you do litigation in that area, they can't turn around in litigation and deny you because you didn't create the jobs.
Right.
So,
well, this is the issue which I would really like you to give me your opinion on, John. I know right now people are resorting to litigation. I feel, for example, some of the mandamus cases, I understand people have been waiting. Some people have not been waiting that much. They've been waiting a year and they want to file a mandamus case. And some people have been waiting 4 years. Understood. But there is a tendency to rush to litigation when it's not necessary.
I would agree with that. I think that obviously we used to, in the old days on mandamus, just look at the processing times and say, well, if you're outside of the processing times, it's ripe for mandamus. The problem is obviously, as we know, the agency quadruple, in my view, the processing times for I-526 and I-29. Does that mean that they're not ripe for mandamus? I wouldn't say that. There's also a different, like a mandamus component, which is just make a decision. But when you file a mandamus, even if the government just adjudicates, the mandamus is to make a decision, not to get an approval. You know, you're going to get a decision. You know, in my experience, and I file literally hundreds, if not a couple thousand mandamus over my lifetime, in the EB-5 context, almost never have I seen an outright approval after a mandamus. You usually get a request for evidence or a notice of intent to deny. So when you file a mandamus, you better be ready.
Yeah.
You better have a complete discussion with your regional center that they're going to have the appropriate evidence to respond to that request for evidence or NOID.
Well, John, we're also seeing that some of the RFEs or NOIDs, which are coming in after a mandamus, are quite harsh. In fact, overly harsh. And here, this brings me to a point that I wanted to ask you about bad faith RFEs.
I don't believe in bad faith RFEs, to be quite honest with you, Mona. I believe that...
What's a bad faith RFE?
Well, we would class a bad faith RFE, Mark, as an RFE which was given by the government, which is unduly burdensome, as in retaliation for the litigation.
Okay.
Again, and I filed thousands. I don't believe you're going to get a worse RFE by filing a mandamus. I think that you're going to get the RFE that you were going to get anyways. I don't believe that the agency...
I wouldn't agree on that one. I have seen some pretty bad things recently.
So have I, but I have seen some pretty bad recently on people that never file a mandamus. And to be clear with you, again, I don't believe that the triggering effect of the bad thing was the mandamus. I believe that the triggering event of the heightened scrutiny has been the change of policies by the administration. And I could, it's beyond the scope of this, but I could cite numerous examples in other visa categories where they have taken positions that had never been taken before.
I really do agree with you. Perhaps that is the right way to look at this, because what we have seen in some RFEs resulting from a mandamus litigation are adjudications or assumptions by USCIS, which bear no logic, which are in a different industry, which is basically, it looks at times as if somebody who's totally incompetent or hasn't even understood the industry is filing or writing the RFE.
I'm not disagreeing with that, Mona. What I would say is actually that's not a disadvantage to you. Once you have a mandamus file and you get an RFE that is making assumptions or is making incorrect assumptions and whatever, if this has happened to me, and in my practice I do this, where let's say ultimately you do the response to the RFE and let's say you get that denial. You can convert or you could file an APA action for or challenging the basis of that denial. And if you think your record is correct, and if you think that the application of the law is incorrect by them, you have an amazing lawsuit on an APA action now. So again, I would...
Sorry, John, just for our listeners, what is an APA action?
Yeah, an APA action is a challenge of the denial, whether it's an I-526 or an I-29 denial, a challenge of the denial under the Administrative Procedures Act or APA, where you're challenging the agency's decision as arbitrary and capricious or contrary to law. So what I'm simply saying to you is the mandamus has been successfully used by my firm many times, where if you get that, let's call it onerous RFE, but they still make a bad decision. It's not based on the record. It's not based on the law. You then have an amazing basis for litigating and overturning it. And to be honest with you, I consider myself lucky. I think it's based on our reputation, but we've been really successful in working with the attorneys, responding to the RFEs and getting a lot of approvals on the mandamus that we have filed. By the same token, though, I do an analysis. There's cases that I say, you know what, this case, you know, your record is horrendous. I think you may get an RFE that you cannot overcome, because you have to anticipate the RFE and the NOIDL, by the way, if you're filing mandamus. And if you don't anticipate it, I don't think you're doing your client a good service. And in anticipating, you got to do some due diligence and research to see, can it be overcome? You know, there's a likelihood of having it overcome.
Now, that's a very good point. And I think if any lawyer is listening, or many of our investor clients who are listening, who are thinking of a mandamus, they really ought to think about RFEs and NOIDs before they even jump into this. Although there is also a school of thought, John, that at least you get your case move forward, even if you do get an RFE, by filing a mandamus.
Correct. I've heard anecdotal that they've been fighting a mandamus, that you're not entitled to get your decision, at least in my experience, within, you know, I would say 60 to about 180 days after filing a mandamus, you get your RFE, you get your NOID, you get your response, you continue the mandamus, and eventually get your decision. Let's remember, though, that there's some people that want to get a decision because they've been waiting for many years. Some of them, actually, in I-526 context, they want to get a decision because if they get denied for project basis, then they can get maybe their money back and go on with their lives. I'm just simply saying that the decision to do a mandamus is by the investor for the investor's benefit, and there has to be a thorough discussion with the lawyers, meaning the lawyer that filed the underlying petition, and then there's a different lawyer for the mandamus to determine the likelihood of success and the steps to be taken.
John, have you dealt with any of the loan proceed issues which have come up lately?
Yes, we have a case in the loan proceeds litigation. We won it. We got a very favorable district court decision, which basically said cash is cash. It doesn't matter how that cash was obtained, if it was a loan that was secured by assets of your parents or someone else. And the district court ruled in our favor. The government inexplicably filed an appeal. We had oral arguments in the District Court of Columbia Circuit Court recently. And based on the questions from the federal judges, they were asking the government, what is ambiguous about cash and the definition
right.
of cash as an investment?
Yeah.
And they just were struggling to simply answer that. So we were involved in litigation. We're continuing to be involved in litigation. And we are very hopeful that we're going to get another precedent decision in a circuit court, which would be the second precedent decision that we would obtain in a circuit court level by the firm.
Right. Well, we brought up this issue about the loan proceeds in previous podcasts. And the other issue which has raised its ugly head time and time again, and it's coming back now, are third-party transfers. Have you dealt with those in litigation?
Not in litigation.
Not yet.
That's correct. I think that part of the issue, and this is closely monitoring by, you know, great lawyers such as yourself, Mona, where you're looking at, you know, normal business practices being challenged by immigration because of ignorance or incompetence or both, whereby obviously they think there's something wrong with it. They just don't like it. And then they make up some sort of policy. That the loan proceeds litigation is a perfect example. They just didn't think it was appropriate for a parent to get a loan secured by, you know, the parent's assets and then give that loan proceeds to the child to make the investment or to someone else. You know, in the normal world, if I get an unsecured loan, that money and I buy a Rolex or a Ferrari or shares in a company, they're my shares. Whether the lender that gave me that unsecured loan can ever go after me for those proceeds, different, but still my money and it's still my property.
John, when we discuss these issues such as loan proceeds and how USCIS are dealing with it, it really does beg a question that we have brought up time and time again. Does USCIS even understand what a preponderance of the evidence is and what is actually needed in order to prove a case? Because to me, it doesn't. They certainly are not following the preponderance of the evidence rules.
I completely agree. I think that this is, again, one of these major shifts that has also affected EB-5. I think that in most immigration cases, if not all, that are filed with the agency, the standard is the preponderance of the evidence, which is 51% or more. If the evidence indicates that 51% or more likelihood that, for example, my money is clean, my money is legitimate, that should be enough. But we have seen a tightening of that requirement. Specifically, I've seen, and I have a litigation on a denial on the source of funds whereby, you know, we believe that it was above and beyond the preponderance of the evidence. We believe that the agency is applying almost a beyond any doubt or reasonable doubt, whereby they're not convinced of the documentation that for many years was more than sufficient to prove your lawful source of funds, but they're no longer, they're questioning it and they're issuing denials on that basis.
John, how are you seeing denials following RFEs for ridiculous questions? For example, we saw an RFE recently where they requested, it was the case of some jewelry which was sold through an auction house. And the RFE actually requested the accounting of the auction house, which is a third party. It's like going out to Sotheby's and saying, give me your accounts. They're going to say, yeah, that's good joke. Go, what's next, you know?
Absolutely. And I think they're requesting things that are not, they're just not feasible. They're inventing it. And this is why I think, you know, let me give you an example too. We saw one RFE whereby they said, well, your funds come from Bank X. And, you know, that bank in that part of the world has been cited for having significant funds from people that were engaged in money laundering. Wait a second. So you mean to tell me that if I had my, you know, my funds where Enron had it at once upon a time, that they could be tainted because they were in the same bank? So, you know, they're saying things that are, I believe, just not legal, because obviously, you know, if I put my legitimate funds in a bank that then turns out, you know, had Deutsche Bank, for Christ's sake, has been found to have engaged in some questionable practices. Does that mean that if I have, you know, $1 million in a bank account in Deutsche Bank, it could be questioned? I would think not.
Well, yeah, the average net worth of most of our investors is way over what's required for the EB-5 at the 500,000 level. So it is really, it just follows on that. I understand that USCIS must prove, they must see that, yes, the funds coming in are legitimate. And to a certain extent, there is a burden on the regional center also to make sure that the funds they use are correct. But where the line is drawn, where do we go? Where do we take it from here, John?
Well, I think obviously it's increasingly, we have to, you know, make a better record, as I indicated in the beginning, have a better record and corroborate it. Let's remember that some countries are mainly cash-based. There's not a lot of tax returns, et cetera, but maybe there you could get creative and you could do some forensic accounting of the businesses and have some reports. Because again, to me, I since I litigate all the time, Mona, I look at it from the litigator's perspective, which is what is my evidence and how do I prove it?
Right.
I have a balance sheet that I submit on my own, but instead of having a balance sheet that is prepared by an accountant and I have the accountant's firm, which one will be given more weight? Which one could be more probative? I think a balance sheet prepared by an accountant that is outside of the company would have a little bit more weight. So you have to think creatively in how to document these things rather than just make a statement.
This is what we have seen on some of the cases which we reviewed just prior to the deadline, is that a lot of immigration lawyers were not doing that. They were just throwing in whatever the investor gave them without questioning. And I think that there is an onus on the immigration lawyer at that point.
I completely agree. I think that one of the most basic cases we do as immigration attorneys, which is marriage cases, I could submit either just a marriage license or I could submit bank account and everything else that proves that they're living together and as a married couple. It's not just the type of evidence, but the quality of evidence that you put in the record, because if immigration then wants to deny it, you have a basis to challenge it in court.
John, we can talk about this subject over and over. I know we have so many more questions that we want to ask, and we would love to have you back on another podcast.
Please let me know. Love to do it.
Thank you, John, for these updates on the litigation in the EB-5 industry, as well as some possible impacts or not so much possible impacts resulting from mandamus filings. John, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.